So I have four lectures in which I want to show you what I think Aquinas understands by the nature of life in grace, the nature of a life of faith. I want to show you what he thinks excellence in Christian life is, but for him, that is also identical to the Christian life. That is, he doesn't think there's mediocre Christians and excellent Christians. He thinks everyone is called to glory. And this state that we are called to has to do with the indwelling Holy Spirit. So it's basically what I want to show you. So what I'm going to do today is, in a sense, prepare the ground for what I want to show you about why this is a good image for the Christian life. I'm going to prepare the ground. I want to tell you what Aquinas thinks about how you should live your life, but for that, I first have to tell you what I don't think Aquinas is saying. So, let's start there. It is customary, it's become almost scholarly dogma, to take Aquinas' ethics as Aristotelian. So, Tony Kinney, famous philosopher at Oxford, he says, he has a kind of a snotty line about Aquinas' ethics. He says, Aquinas' endeavor to bring together the evangelical, the Christian approach to ethics, and the Aristotelian text can hardly be regarded as successful. What's remarkable about Aquinas' attempt to bring the Christian and the Aristotelian together is not that it's done successfully, but that he thinks he can do it at all. It's noteworthy, Kenny goes on to say, that the Christian text, the Christian approach to ethics, are distorted to fit the Aristotelian context rather than the other way around. So that's Tony Kinney on Aquinas' ethics. And there are a number of interpretations that follow suit. Now, what you have to understand is if you take Aquinas as an Aristotelian in ethics, then this is what you've got. You've got a virtue-based ethics, an ethics centered in the virtues. And on this approach then, if this is right, a moral virtue is a habit. It's acquired through practice. It disposes the will to act in accordance with reason. And the passions, anything that counts as an emotion, is at best kind of a caboose on the train of moral virtue, and at worst gets in the way of moral virtue. So it's all about reason, and it's all about practice, and it's all about self-discipline, and so on. So here's a representative explanation. This is Peter King, a person who works in medieval philosophy at Toronto. He says, Aquinas holds, as against Hume, Aquinas holds that reason is and ought to be the ruler of the passions. Since the passions can be controlled by reason, they should be controlled by reason. And then here's Robert George, who's a kind of a famous public figure interested in Aquinas. He says, moral philosophy is a contest between Aristotle and David Hume. And he's got Aquinas on the Aristotle side, of course. In a well-ordered soul, reason has got the whip hand over emotion. So that's their idea of how to understand Aquinas. On the view of Robert George, in ethics such as that of Hume, which centers ethics in the passions, that can never give us a reasonable, appropriate ethics. For Robert George, the Aristotelian ethics of Aquinas is preferable because, George thinks, Aquinas' Aristotelian ethics grounds all virtue in reason. So that's the idea. Now, I happen to think all those folks are wrong, dead wrong, completely wrong, and you'll be happy to know I'm not a minority of one. Yeah?
There's something wrong with it. It's
barely
projecting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, you're just going to have to put up with it, I guess. Or let's see, we can try it this way. Let's see how that works. No, that doesn't help at all. I forgot my cords, so we may do with substitute cords, and it doesn't work quite right.
Okay.
So we will just have to make the best of it. So Gene Porter, a very good philosophical theologian at Notre Dame, Gene Porter says, there's a tendency among Aquinas scholars, misleading and prevalent, to read Aquinas as if he were only baptized Aristotle. but is himself little more than Aristotle baptized. That is, she thinks it's a mistake to see Aquinas as Aristotelian in ethics and is adding nothing to Aristotle in effect. Now, what I want to say is, if you think about this a minute, so Jean Porter represents a new trend in thinking about Aquinas' ethics. It's a trend gaining adherence and, in my view, is completely right. If you think about it, if you think about it for a minute, you can see that it ought to be the Jean Porter way. It ought to be that Aquinas does not have an Aristotelian ethics, and here's why. Think about it this way. Think about the metaphysics that goes with the ethics. The ultimate foundation of all reality for Aquinas is the Trinity. And that's clearly not the ultimate foundation of reality for Aristotle. But since that is the ultimate explanation of, since that is the explanation of ultimate reality for Aquinas, here's what you need to notice. At the ultimate foundation of reality, there's personal relationship which is not reducible to anything else. There's a joke philosophers like to tell that goes like this. Some famous philosopher is giving a lecture about the ultimate foundation of all reality, and the little lady in the audience jumps up and says, "Sir, sir, I think the earth rests on a turtle." And he says to her, "Ma'am, ma'am, what does the turtle rest on?" And she says, "It's turtles all the way down." Well, for Christians, it's persons all the way down. At the very bottom, it's persons, and there's nothing that the persons are reducible to. That is, on the doctrine of the Trinity, the three persons of the Trinity aren't reducible to the one Godhead or anything else at all. They're not reducible to modes of the Godhead. And the interrelations among the persons, the interrelations of love, those are also not reducible to anything. That's what it is. It's love and interpersonal relation and persons all the way down. So on Aristotle's pagan worldview, we get a very different understanding of basic metaphysics from the view we get on Aquinas' metaphysics, and that difference in metaphysics has far-ranging effects everywhere else in philosophy, but especially in ethics. Now, here's my claim. Aquinas' ethics is not Aristotelian. So how does it work? A person gets an Aristotelian virtue by practicing it, by doing acts of the sort that yield the disposition of the virtue when those acts have been done often enough. That's how you get Aristotelian virtue. Aristotelian virtue is an acquired characteristic. And each Aristotelian virtue is an intrinsic characteristic. It's a property that can be gotten and preserved by an individual acting by himself as an agent in his own right. And here's the thing. Neither of those things is true of what Aquinas takes to be the real virtues. You don't get it for yourself, and it isn't an intrinsic characteristic, it's a relational characteristic, a second personal relational characteristic. So Aquinas himself affirms Augustine's definition of a virtue. This is it. A virtue is a good quality of the mind by which one lives righteously, of which no one can make bad use, and which God works in us without us. And Aquinas says that Augustinian definition comprises perfectly the whole formula of virtue. So you can see that's an un-Aristotelian definition because you can't acquire for yourself by practice a disposition that God puts into you without you. That definition of a virtue will not fit an Aristotelian virtue. Now, Aquinas recognizes that the Aristotelian virtues acquired through practice of the acts correlated with a virtue He recognizes that they don't fit that Augustinian definition of a virtue because of the last clause, which God works in us without us. And so Aquinas says, acquired virtues, that's the Aristotelian ones, acquired virtues, to which these words do not apply, acquired virtue is not of the same species as infused virtue. But the infused virtues, the virtues infused by God, are the real ones. So those Aristotelian or acquired virtues, they aren't habits that contain the whole formula of virtue. The real definition of virtue for Aquinas does not apply to the Aristotelian virtues. Now Aquinas accepts something called the unity of the virtues thesis. And that's actually a very weird and a very interesting thing. The unity of the virtues thesis says that if you've got one virtue, you've got all of them. If you lose one, you lose all of them. And Aquinas adds to this that you get them all in an instant. Aquinas thinks a person comes to faith in an instant, a datable instant, and in that same instant, the person gets not only faith, but also all the other virtues and everything else that goes into a morally excellent life all at once. And he also thinks if you lose anything on that list, if you lose courage or something of that sort, you lose all the rest of them. Now that's a fairly, what do you want to say, fairly crazy sounding claim, right? It's not a claim we would ordinarily believe, and it certainly is not a claim that applies to the acquired virtues. That is, the acquired virtues look as if you can get them one by one. So it looks as if the unity of the virtues thesis doesn't apply. And Aquinas recognizes that the unity of the virtues thesis doesn't apply to acquired virtues. So he says, if a person exercises himself by good deeds in regard to one matter, but not in regard to another, for instance, by behaving well in matters of anger, but not behaving well in matters of concupiscence, then he will indeed acquire a certain habit of restraining his anger, but, and here's the crucial line, but this habit will lack the formula of virtue. So you can get a disposition of restraining your anger, and that looks as if it would be a real virtue. And Aquinas says, no, because you got it by exercising yourself in the acts correlated with the virtue, and you got this virtue rather than some other virtue, the habit that you've got lacks the formula of virtue. It's not a real virtue. Furthermore, think about it this way. On Aquinas' view, the heart of all human excellence, all moral excellence, is love. And so Aquinas thinks there can't be, because he holds unity of the virtues thesis, he thinks there can't be any virtue at all without love, but love has got to be infused into a person by God. So here's what Aquinas says. It's written, he who does not love abides in death. Now the spiritual life is perfected by the virtues, since it's by the virtues that we live rightly, and therefore the virtues can't be without love. But since love is infused, those other virtues have to be infused too, and so you can't acquire a virtue for yourself by practice. That's the idea. Now Aquinas considers an objection. The objector says, moral virtues can be acquired by means of human acts, but love can't. So the only way to get love is by getting it infused by God. And so it's possible to have the other virtues without love. So Aquinas, you're wrong that there's no virtue unless there's also love. That's how the objection goes. And Aquinas' answer to that objection is this. He says, well, this argument holds good for moral virtue in the sense of acquired virtue. That is, he's conceding that you can acquire some Aristotelian virtues if you don't have the infused disposition of love. He agrees, the objection's got that right. But But here's the point. Those acquired virtues are not real virtues, and that's why this argument isn't an objection that works against him when he says there are no virtues without love. Because the virtues you can get without love aren't real virtues, on his view. So that's how that goes. And here's another way to look at the same issue of the unity of the virtues. Aquinas asked this question, is it possible to have the infused virtue of love and not have all the moral virtues? Is that possible? And he says, no, it isn't. All the moral virtues are infused simultaneously together with love. And that's what we'd expect from the unity of the virtues thesis, see? So, what I hope that brief rundown has shown you is this. We have in Aquinas a non-Aristotelian virtue ethics. And on this non-Aristotelian virtue ethics, all things that really count as virtue are infused into a person by God all at once. And notice this, the key to all of it is love, and love counts as an emotion or as a passion. So contrary to the position I showed you at the outset, where the idea is in a well-ordered life, reason has the whip hand over emotion, actually for Aquinas, it's the other way around. In a well-ordered soul, love is first, and everything is ordered in the psyche by love. That's the basis for the ethics. And as we go on, what I want to show you is not only that for Aquinas, in that first instant of faith, love is infused and all the other virtues are infused, but in addition, all the gifts and all the fruits of the Holy Spirit are also infused. They're also infused. So that at one and the same moment, in the acquisition in the acquisition of faith, you get faith, hope, love, wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance, and all the gifts and all the fruits of the Holy Spirit, and we're still not done. You also get God himself, because in the same instant Aquinas thinks, you get the indwelling Holy Spirit. So that's sort of the outline for what I want to show you in the next lectures. I want to show you, see, when you first hear this idea, you're likely to think a couple of thoughts. One, that's crazy. I know people who are brave, but they're not temperate, or temperate, but not brave, and so on. And then you're also likely to think to yourself, look, how could anything be a virtue? How could anything be a virtue if it's infused? A virtue is something you have to get for yourself, or it doesn't count as a real virtue. But if you're thinking that way, on that second thought, you're forgetting that what we have in Aquinas is a powerful rejection of Pelagianism. And if we reject Pelagianism, we cannot have an Aristotelianism in ethics. So here's the thing about Pelagianism. To reject Pelagianism, you need to accept this position. Any good in a human being, any good at all, is a result of God's grace. And there is no good in a human being that a human being gets for himself, by himself. And that's why the good things in a human being, the virtues, for example, they have to be infused. You can't get them for yourself. And, you know, if you want to talk at some point about Pelagianism, we can do that. But I mention it just to help you understand this position, which you might be inclined to reject as not really Thomistic. You can see that it should be Thomistic when you remember about Pelagianism. Because if Aquinas were an Aristotelian, he would also be, in ethics, he would also be a Pelagian. So I point out to you two reasons for worrying about this position. It looks as if it attributes to Aquinas a theory of virtue that isn't really virtue because you didn't struggle to get it. And it also looks counterintuitive because it's hard to believe you can get all the virtues at once in an instant. It's much easier to believe you get them through a long struggle. So those are two things that are very odd about his position, but I hope you'll see as we go along why he holds this and how it makes sense. So that's as far as I was going to get right now. Here's where we're going. In the next lecture, I want to show you what Aquinas thinks the bad stuff is. You can get the bad stuff for yourself. And so I want to show you what he thinks the bad stuff is so we clear the ground that way too and are ready then to move on to the virtues, the fruits, and the gifts. But the next lecture, what we will talk about is the seven deadly sins, what they are, what they consist in, why they're deadly, how they connect to love, and so on. So that's where we'll go for the next lecture, and then we will turn to the indwelling Holy Spirit and the virtues and the gifts and fruits of the Holy Spirit. So that's the plan. So I raced real fast, but that leaves us some time for questions. Shall we have some questions? Do I have questions? Yeah.
I was wondering, because I'm a bit confused on what is the difference between the infused virtues and the gift of the Holy Spirit.
That's a good question. So, I'm pausing because I don't want to give my other lecture away. I'm trying to think how to answer the question I gave the lecture. So, the idea is kind of like this. Consider everything I think of to tell you. I realize I've gotten a lecture later, but it's okay. Maybe we'll just have it twice. So consider justice. Justice is an Aristotelian virtue. As an Aristotelian virtue, it's a matter of giving to everybody his due. So you're a student in my class, I owe you teaching and paper grading and office hours and stuff like that. That's your due as my student. Justice as an infused virtue is a matter of giving to every human being his or her due when that human being is considered as a child of God, as a member of the heavenly kingdom or something of that sort. So now we've got an expanded sense of what is due. So Chrysostom and Ambrose, these great patristic thinkers, they say, if you have two pairs of shoes and you don't need them both, and you don't give one pair of shoes away to the poor, you're guilty of theft. Not of lack of mercy, but theft. Now, how does that work out? Well, because what is due to each person is that the earth should sustain God's creatures in the way he intended it to do. And if you have more than you need and the other guy has less than he needs, then the earth is not sustaining its creatures in the way God intended it to do, and so you're guilty of theft. So this is a very powerful, you might say, very powerful anti-capitalistic understanding of justice. When justice becomes transposed as a gift of the Holy Spirit, it alters its character in a radical kind of a way. So, justice as a gift of the Holy Spirit becomes pietas. Now, I noticed that your book on the gifts of the Holy Spirit has a lot to say about pietas, and it doesn't include anything of what I'm going to say, and that's just the way the world is sometimes. So, pietas is a Roman virtue. It comes out of the Roman world, and it's made famous by Virgil's Aeneid. Virgil's main character, a guy named Aeneas, is always called Pious Aeneas. He's the iconic representation of the virtue of piety. And here's why. Aeneas' city is Troy. That's his whole planet. That's planet Troy, like planet Earth for him. And his city is destroyed by the invading Greeks. They're killing, they're burning, they're destroying everything around them. They're like the Death Star for Troy. And all the people in Troy are going crazy. Their world is being completely destroyed, and they're trying to get out of there before they're part of the destruction. In those circumstances, Aeneas puts his dad on his shoulders. Now, there is something that will slow you down. And on top of that, takes his little boy by the hand. That will slow you down. And he gets himself out of the burning city and away from the invaders of the Greeks who are killing everybody with his father on his shoulder and his little boy in his hand. That's the iconic picture of piety. And I'm sorry to tell you this, but it's a virtue about fathers and sons. Aeneas actually had a wife to go with that little boy, but he didn't hold her or carry her. She got lost in Troy and she got killed. She never made it out. So this is a virtue about fathers and sons, and it gets extended. So it's what you owe. Piety becomes what you owe to anything which can be considered your father. So there's your country which nourished you, or your alma mater which nourished you, or your teachers that nourished you. Whatever can count as your father is somebody to whom you owe the debt of pietas. When it comes into the Christian world, pietas alters its character like this. The father in question is your father in heaven, and every human being without any exception whatsoever is the child of your father in heaven. So insofar as you owe a debt to your father in heaven, you owe a debt to him to treat every human being who crosses your path as the beloved child of your father. Now that's a long transposition of the notion of justice. See what I mean? Now justice has become not giving the other guy what is his due, where it's this much, but don't worry, you don't have to give any more than that. You gave him $10, that's it, you're done. Now what you have to give him is everything. Why? Because the beloved child of your father in heaven, what do you think is enough? Put it like this. Suppose you've fallen in love with somebody who's got a child from a previous relationship and you really want this person to marry you. And now how are you going to treat this child? Like the Queen of Sheba, right? There is simply not enough you can do for this child, right? Why? Because this child is the beloved child of this person you're trying to be in union with. That's pietas as a gift of the Holy Spirit. Except even there I'm not really done, because every gift of the Holy Spirit is second personal in character. So justice is an intrinsic characteristic. You can have it by yourself. But the gifts of the Holy Spirit are not like that. The gifts of the Holy Spirit are brought when the Holy Spirit is within you, making you the friend of God with whom you can be in conversation. So when the person who eats egg salad with his mouth open at the breakfast table next to you drives you absolutely homicidal at the sight, you will need not only to remember that this person is the beloved child of your Father in heaven, but also you'll be remembering it with God with you, with the Holy Spirit with you. And the two of you together can figure out what to do about the fact that the schmutzing of the egg salad makes you homicidal. So that's what happens when these things transpose those gifts to the Holy Spirit. They become second personal. They connect you to God, with God with you in that connection. That's what happened. So that was a long answer, but I couldn't help it. He asked a good question. Yeah.
So this makes me think of the problem that the Reformation debates about whether we can do good without grace.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of two parts of this. One, Trent says we can do good without grace, and And secondly, when we say, when you sort of gesture, we don't have virtues without infusion. Does that mean our actions without grace, according to whatever status these acquired virtues have, is not good in the sense of, merely in the sense of not meritorious of beatitude? Or does it mean also that they are blameworthy and, in some sense, demeritorious, meritorious of damnation? You see what I'm saying? So
yep.
Are they just, yeah.
So what I want to say about Trent is I don't have a license to talk about Trent. It falls outside my area of professional competence. So I'd have to go look at the text very carefully to see. But I will say that I would be astonished if Trent espoused Pelagianism. I would be really astonished. So, but I don't have a license to say. Basically, in the Christian tradition, from the very earliest days on, the Christian community considered that expertise in matters of theology was vested in community, and in community, it labeled some things heresy. And a heresy is something that the community as a whole has thought deeply and powerfully about and has decided, look, it's a dead end. Go that way, and you just run into a wall. So every body of expertise has its heresy. In biology, Lysenkoism is a heresy. The community has examined, the community biology has examined Lysenkoism, and it doesn't work. And so if you want to, you know, rule somebody out of court in a biological discussion, you can say, isn't that perilously close to Lysenkoism? And then we know, non-starter. It's very helpful for any human endeavor where expertise is vested in the community to have a sense of heresy, because it enables you to appropriate the experience of the community where the community has found that something is really unworkable. And from the time of Augustine onwards, Pelagianism has been a heresy. And for sure and certain, whatever Luther thought about Catholics, Aquinas for sure and certain rejects Pelagianism explicitly over and over again. So for sure, that is his position. Now, there's a metaphysical reason for his position. See, I guess what I want to say is this. Aquinas is not gospel. He's not God. He gets things wrong, releases things undeveloped. But this is what he is, one of the smartest thinkers in the Western tradition. And he appropriates over 1,000 years of very smart thought on the issues he's considering. So he's kind of like, you might say, the very best of Wikipedia. See, everything that everybody else has figured out gets poured into that, and what the result is communal expertise. The expertise of the Christian community in these issues is in Aquinas combined with his own powerful mind's development of them. So although he's not gospel and gets things wrong too, nonetheless, he is very helpful for us. We can learn a great deal from him. So what Aquinas wants to say is that for the virtues, the acquired virtues, the Aristotelian virtues, those dispositions you get for yourself, for those things, you can be in hell if you have all of them. You can have all of them and be suitably damned. And why? Because you can have all of them and be in mortal sin. That's the idea. So it's only through the infused virtues and only through the indwelling Holy Spirit that you have the minimum necessary condition for salvation.
So you act in accordance with those acquired virtues. Does that contribute to your, say, gains of sense or something? Is it blameworthy in that sense? It increases your.
You have to make a distinction. So it depends on how you're doing this act without charity. So so consider Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's, you know, second in command. He had a certain amount of courage. No, he was brave in the face of physical danger. But in his case, the acts of courage that he did were done with an explicit and overt rejection of Christianity, explicit and overt rejection of Caritas. So he's somebody who's aware of the Christian tradition. He's somebody who was raised Catholic and rejected it and substituted his own virtues instead. There, I think it's appropriate to say he heaps damnation on himself by what he does. It's also possible to have people who are, you might say, real, honest-to-goodness pagans who haven't rejected Christianity or rejected Caritas, but who simply, for whom it has never been a live option, you might say. And then when they do something that is courageous, then what you can say is there's something that's humanly admirable about it, but it still doesn't count as a real virtue. You've had your hand up so long.
I guess I'm curious, this notion that all of the infused virtues, they're all infused at once, you have them all through love. How does that connect with the notion of spiritual progress?
Because you get them in an incipient degree. Love and virtue are like a rheostat. It's an all or nothing thing whether the light is on. But once the light is on, it can be brighter and brighter and brighter, or dimmer and dimmer. So you get these things all at once, because whether you have them or don't have them is an all or nothing thing. But once you've got them, they can steadily increase. That's how it works. Yeah, in the back.
So you said that Aquinas thinks love is a passion. I was just wondering if you could provide some reasons for thinking that he does think love is a passion, and then if he does, what does he define passion as?
Okay, so I'm going to answer that question, but I want you to understand that so far I have not heard a single soprano voice. Now, do you think that that's a good idea? So when we're done with this question, just make up your mind, either one of you will be brave or I will simply call on somebody. Okay. So there are three senses of passion in Aquinas. You can think of Aquinas' notion of passion as a kind of a three-layer cake. There's the bottom level, the middle level, and the top level to your cake. Aquinas thinks that you have built into you two very different faculties of desiring. One faculty of desiring is very low level. You're trying and trying and trying to get your papers graded. And finally, you're aware that you're drooling. And you think, what's going on with me? And you realize, oh, over there somebody's baking bread and I am really hungry. Now, the desire that you had there was a desire that sailed in under the level of the reason. It was a desire prompted by something in sense perception that didn't make it all the way up into full-fledged conscious reasoning. That kind of desire is a passion, strictly speaking, lowest level sense of passion. And the primary one of the passions there is love. Now, you've also got a capacity, a mechanism for desire connected to reason. That's a desire that you have when, realizing you're hungry and you're drooling over the baking bread, you say to yourself, the heck with it, I'm not getting up until I've got these papers graded. Now you've got a desire to get the papers graded, and it's not a desire that's responsive to sense perception, it's responsive to reason. You can say, I've been dawdling way too long, I've been interrupted way too many times, I'm getting these papers graded and I'm not moving till they're done. That's a desire too, but it's not a sensory desire. So what we get in that regard is a passion that is connected to the reason, and there we can have love also. There also love is a primary, love is also a primary passion there. And then finally, we can have We can have love as a theological virtue. And then it's the greatest of all the elements in the moral life. It's the greatest state of the moral life. But then it's second personal in relation, and it's a function of second personal relation to God and the indwelling Holy Spirit. So that's how it works. The fruits of the Holy Spirit are, there are 12 fruits of the Holy Spirit, and the first one is love. But now we have the third part of the layer cake, see? Because that's love too, but it's not love that is responsive to a sensory perception. It's not love that's responsive to reasons figuring things out for you. It's love that is a fruit of the indwelling Holy Spirit. So that's what a passion is. Okay, so you remember I said I had to hear a soprano voice? Oh, good for you. Courage in action, see that? Okay.
This is kind of following off of Ross's question, but is there any status, I mean, what exactly is the status of these non-virtues, the kind of non-meritorious good deeds? Is there any way that those can somehow orient your, I mean, I think the answer is no for Aquinas, but is there any kind of, do they help the person at all get to a point where they can surrender their will and enter it? I mean, not get, it's bad language, but it's not to exactly get you into meritorious grace or something like that, but is there something like redeeming grace with, I guess, just pagan good works? I don't know how else.
It's a great question, but it's got two questions built into it, and one of those questions has as its assumption something really funny and really wrong, and the other one has something marvelous attached to it. So let's take the one that has something funny and wrong built into it. So let's start with that, because that's easier to deal with. The other one is it really interesting and complicated. And, you know, I forgot when we quit. Are we getting perilously close to the time you said something else was going to happen?
We should stop soon, but watch base this question, and then we'll go down.
Okay. Okay, so here's the part that's funny and bad. So this question has got kind of a sad hope in it that goes like this. Couldn't I somehow deserve grace? If I worked really hard, wouldn't that mean I'd be more likely to give me grace, the grace that gets all this good stuff? Couldn't I sort of work my way into the position where God would give me this stuff? And the answer is no, that's Pelagian. Remember Pelagianism? No, that's Pelagianism. Nothing good in you that isn't put there by God. So you can't do a good act in advance of grace, only after grace. That's the whole point. But, the other part of the question is really cool and it's got something really deep in it, and it goes kind of like this. The other part of the question is, isn't there anything good about my struggling? I mean, isn't there anything good to, you know, deny yourself and being grim and working hard? Isn't there anything good about that? And the answer is yes, because, see, here's the interesting thing to notice. Even on the rejection of Pelagianism, what is still totally within your control is doing bad stuff. And when God puts the infused virtues in, he doesn't take out the bad dispositions you put in there by yourself. They stay in there, and they are in there in conflict with the good stuff. So, I mean, if you want to know how this works, it goes like this. For Aquinas, God acts on the will with formal causation, not with efficient causation. Efficient causation expels a preceding configuration. Formal causation doesn't. So since God acts on the will with formal causation, he doesn't expel from the will the bad habits you put there. And if you put them there, if you let them sit there, if you don't work against them, then the virtues that God puts in will be fighting with you, within you, all the time. And where do we find a marvelous picture of this? In Romans 7, what does Paul say in Romans 7? The good that I would that I do not, what I would not do, that is what I do. And why? Because in me, I find two laws, the law of nature and the law of grace, and they fight within me. So the point is, if you've got a lifetime habit of eating crummy food and not exercising, and God puts into you temperance, you're going to be engaged in civil war within yourself between the bad habits you put there and the temperance that God puts in there. And sometimes one of these will win and sometimes the other one will win. You are way ahead if you don't put the bad stuff in there as habit in the first place. See what I mean? So there's a lot of good to be said there, but what it isn't going to count as is good that you do. That isn't what it's going to count as. It's going to be the avoidance of building bad habits, which is what you can do by yourself.